Rise for the prayer by our chaplain, Pastor Gock, followed by the Pledge of Allegiance to our flag.
Meister Eckhart wrote, "Wisdom consists in doing the next thing you have to do, doing it with your whole heart, and finding delight in doing it." Gracious God, as we rush through this day, may we put our total selves into what must be done, so that it may not have to be done. Help us, therefore, to be mindful of the small things, such as small acts of kindness and courtesy, caring and shared joy. Help us embrace all that is about us completely, being present with all that we encounter. In your holy name we pray. Amen.
Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Secretary, call the roll.
Senators Brown, Chappelle Nadal, Cunningham, Curls, Dempsey, Dixon, Emery, Holzman, Justice, Kevney, Kehoe, Kraus, Lager, Lamping, Lavoda, Libla, McKenna, Munslinger, Nasheed, Nieves, Parson, Pierce, Richard, Romine, Roop, Sater, Schaff, Schaefer, Schmidt, Sifton, Sylvie, Wallingford, Walsh, Wasson.
Senator from Webster. Senator from Andrew. A quorum is present. The Missouri Senate is now in session. Secretary, read the journal.
Journal of the Senate, first regular session, 14th day, Monday, February 4th, 2013.
Mr. President.
Senator from Newton.
I move that further reading of the journal be dispensed with and the same be approved as though it has been fully read. Also, would like to announce photographers from Missouri News Horizon, Missouri Lawyers Media, and KCTV have been given permission to take flash pictures and video in the Senate chamber.
You've heard the motion. As many as are the opinion, it shall prevail. Say aye. Those of the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Reading is dispensed with. Introduction of guests. The senator from Buchanan was on his feet.
Mr. President, to your right and my left on the couch over here, we have several students from Missouri Western State University, Jason Scott, Brian Shule, Montario Seawood, Mary Beth Rosenauer, and Amat Shah Salami. And they're here to help us celebrate Great Northwest Days at the Capitol today, and I would ask the body to welcome them.
Will all the guests of the senator from Buchanan please rise for a welcome and recognition by the Missouri Senate. The senator from the 11th.
I'd like to introduce a special guest, Mr. President. I'd like to introduce from Independence, Missouri, Rory Rowland, who's a constituent of mine, a very good friend, and a master motivational speaker.
We're delighted to welcome the guest of the senator from the 11th to the Missouri Senate. Senator from Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is a great day for us. Another year of the Great Northwest Days, and we have 350 of my closest friends who have made the journey down to enlighten all of the great members of the Senate. So as they come by, listen to them and do exactly what they ask you to do. With that, Mr. President, I would ask the members of the Senate to please join me in welcoming many of the folks from Northwest Missouri who made the trip.
All the guests of the senator from Andrew from the Great Northwest, please rise for recognition by the Senate. Introductions of guests. Senator from 24th.
President, I'd like to introduce a special guest. On my left, come on out, Julie. Joining us today is Julie Blott. I'm fortunate enough to have her as an intern in my office this semester. Julie's a graduate of the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, where she obtained a degree in social work. She's currently enrolled at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University. where she's working towards a master's degree with a concentration in mental health. This is a continuation of an internship program we started last year. Julie's focus is going to be policy research in the areas of health, mental health, seniors, and families. I'm just thrilled to have her be on our staff. She's a great asset to my team. I'd ask that my colleagues welcome her.
Let's welcome this guest of the Senator from 24th. To Ms. Senator from Johnson.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Could I inquire the Senator from Nottoway?
Does the Senator from Andrew yield?
I do.
Senator, yield, you may inquire.
I couldn't help from you notice you said you had 350 friends.
Yep. It's all, every one of them are here today.
Really? That's incredible.
Except for my wife, who has to live with me and who boycotted and wouldn't come.
Okay, it seemed a little high, but anyway. Anyway, it's Great Northwest Day.
It is.
Due to redistricting.
You now represent some of the great folks in
Northwest Missouri. I had the opportunity to take some districts that you had served. And so Livingston and Caldwell County are part of that. So I am going to be a part of that. And I ask that you'll be my mentor. Throughout this whole process, because it's
Senator, there are a lot of people in here that'd be very happy to hear that I'm going to be your mentor. But we welcome you to the Northwest delegation. There's now two of us, we're grateful to have all these wonderful people here.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing all 350 of your friends.
That sounds great,
Mr. President. I do have some special guests in addition to the senator from Atchison's 350 friends. They're athletic trainers that are here today. And they are, if they would please stand, they are Josh Thompson, Morgan Simpson, and John Donnell. And they one comes from my district, the 21st, and the others are from the senator from Cole and the senator from Polk County. So I'd like to welcome the athletic trainers.
Let's welcome these special guests of the senator from Johnson to the Missouri Senate today. Introductions. Senator from the 3rd.
Mr. President, up to my left and to your right in the gallery, have friend and Dr. Comiskey from Jefferson College in Jefferson County. Please recognize him today for me, please.
I began yesterday with breakfast with Dr. Comiskey and with you. Let's welcome the special guest to the Missouri Senate. Further introductions, petitions, memorials, remonstrances, resolutions. Concurrent resolutions. Introduction of bills. Senator from Cole.
I have a bill.
Send it forward, Senator. Read the bill.
Senate Joint Resolution Number 19, introduced by Senator Kehoe. 16. That's Senate Joint Resolution Number 16, introduced by Senator Kehoe and Senator McKenna. Joint Resolution relating to a temporary tax to improve the state highway system.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Senator from Jefferson County and I just recently attended an event with hundreds of people who gathered around us to talk about a possible solution to Missouri's transportation infrastructure needs. This allows the citizens to decide on a limited time investment that would get our state's economy going and provide much needed infrastructure across the state. We've had this conversation for years and years and years. There's lots of potential fixes floating around in this building. This could be one of them, and we look forward to fully discussing this with our colleagues and trying to move Missouri's infrastructure system forward. Thank you, Mr. President.
Introduction of bills. Senator from the 2nd.
I have one bill.
Send it forward, sir.
It's mandatory, and there's no explanation.
Read the bill.
Senate Bill number 261, introduced by Senator Roop, an act relating to the assignment of hearing officers by the State Tax Commission.
Introduction of bills. Senator from the Ninth.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have two bills.
Send your bills forward. Read the first bill.
Senate Bill number 262, introduced by Senator Curls, an act relating to the reimbursement of covered health care services provided through telemedicine.
Senator, read the second bill.
Senate Bill number 263, introduced by Senator Curls, an act relating to the creation of the crime of assaulting an employee of a mass transit system while in the scope of his or her duties.
Senator, would you like to explain that bill?
No explanation necessary.
Further introduction of bills? Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a bill. No explanation necessary.
Please send the bill forward. Madam Secretary, please read the bill.
Senate Bill number 264, introduced by Senator Dempsey, an act relating to petitions to exclude property from a fire protection district.
Further introduction of bills. Seeing none, Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Can I request unanimous consent to introduce a new employee?
Seeing no objection to the unanimous consent motion made by the Senator from the 23rd, the floor is yours, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President. Standing right behind me, we have our new doorman, Marty Drool, and I ask members, please give him a warm welcome to the Senate chamber.
We are on the Senator from Boone, for what reason do you rise?
Inquire the Senator from Clay.
Senator from Clay, the Senator from Boone would like to inquire of you. Are you yielding to him?
I am, Mr. President.
Proceed, Senator.
Senator, you see yesterday the governor released $8.5 million in withholds to higher education.
I noticed that.
And I wanted to point out what you and I dealt with last year, us on this side in the Appropriations Committee and you with your Budget Committee over in the House. And that was, we were given a budget with a 12% cut to higher education. Do you remember that?
I do, very
over,
well.
Over $100 million of a cut to higher education, which would have been the largest cut in the history of the state of Missouri to higher education.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yeah. Oh, I remember very clearly that he wanted to make a $100 million cut to higher education and still managed to spend more than consensus revenue in his proposal.
That's right. And you and your chamber and us in this chamber over here had to make some very hard decisions about what we were going to spend the state's money on. But we were able to undo that cut. And I want to thank you for your work last year. I know that when that started out in the House, it was a priority of yours. It was a priority of ours over here. So I'm certainly glad that the governor has released the $8.5 million that he was continuing to withhold, even though we're over $100 million in the black in additional general revenue for this year. But it did remind me of the work that we did last year, and I wanted to thank you for that work.
Well, I appreciate that. If you would indulge, do you know, in his 14 requests, if I remember right, it seemed that they were saying that the withhold was going to be permanent, but it wasn't going to be a cut. Do you remember this conversation last week with Linda?
Yes.
No, now that he's released the money.
Right, because his proposal, right, because he carried over the withhold.
Did. So now that there is no withhold, do you know how that affects Virginia?
I don't.
That's a good question.
Since yesterday I haven't had a chance to ask, but we'll find that out.
It sounds like a good plan, Senator.
Thanks, Senator.
All right, thank you.
We're on the order of business of introduction of bills. Senator from the 24th, for what reason do you rise?
Inquire the Senator from Boone.
Senator from Boone, the Senator from the 24th would like to inquire of you.
I yield.
Proceed, Senator.
Senator, much discussion is being had about at the federal level that the executive branch is ruling more and more by executive fiat and avoiding the process and really essentially avoiding the rule of law. So is today's discussion with the senator from Clay, I mean, does this lead you to think that on some level this is happening here at the state level?
Well, I mean, I can give you examples from the budget and what we've seen on withholds. You know, the Missouri Constitution is pretty clear. The General Assembly appropriates money for a given purpose, and that's the money for that program or purpose. There's an escape hatch, basically, in the Constitution that allows the governor to withhold and control the rate of expenditure on a given line item if it appears that the state is not going to make budget. And the thing is, that's never happened, yet we've had massive withholds. In other words, the governor overriding what the General Assembly has determined the public's money should be spent on, and then the governor simply doesn't release it. And that, you know, that's unprecedented with this administration at a level that this state has never seen before.
So, I mean, again, I think our consensus revenue estimate for this fiscal year was 3.9% growth in revenues.
That was what we budgeted for the year.
Right.
But as we do every year, 6 months into the year, we do a revised consensus revenue estimate, which even in December when we did that was raised to 4.7. But, you know, we've been clicking along over 8 now for weeks, and we're over 9 now this
right.
week.
On that point, what you're going to find is there was a tremendous amount of income realized in the fourth quarter.
Correct.
And that was just income that was pulled into this tax year with anticipation of higher federal tax rates. So I think you're going to see a little bit of a give back. But the point is, though, is that this it makes sense that the executive would have the ability to withhold in a time of crisis, withhold when it's apparent to all that the budget will not be met. But
right.
what this governor has done is he's decided to kind of forego the process, your committee, the budget that's passed in the House, and just allocate as he sees fit.
Right, and essentially, so, for example, what the governor's been doing is he then carries that money over into the following year and puts it in his budget somewhere other than where we determine the money should be spent.
Yeah, so I think the governor's, you know, he's had a concurrent time in office at the federal level. We've had an administration that's been in place for 4 years. I think he's kind of learning from them. I think to some extent he's been copying them from the very beginning to where, yeah, there's law and there's process and there's other branches of government, but as long as nobody calls you on it, you can do what you want to do.
That is what we're seeing. That's correct.
Thank you for your inquiry, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
We are on the order of business of introduction of bills. Does any other senator have bills that need to be introduced? Seeing none, Senator from the 32nd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go over the business of Senate bills for perfection. I would ask you recognize the Senator from the 2nd on Senate Bill 1.
Senator, you're requesting to go to the informal calendar. We are on the order of business of Senate bills for perfection. The senior senator from St. Charles, the senator from the 2nd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate Bill number 1 with the Senate Committee substitute be brought before the body.
You've heard the motion, the senator from the 2nd. All the senators believe that a motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The ayes appear to have it, the ayes do have it. The bill's before the body, senator from the 2nd.
Thank you, Mr. President. There's an amendment within an amendment to amendment. I'd like to ask that my original amendment be sent back.
Please send back the underlying amendment, Senate Amendment number 1. I'm sorry, Senate Amendment number 2 shall be returned.
Thank you, Mr. President. And I have a Senate substitute I'd like to send forward. It has been distributed, and I would ask for a waiver of the reading.
Please send the substitute forward. Hearing no objection, there shall be a waiver of the reading.
Thank you, Mr. President. I now move for the adoption of the Senate substitute. Move for its adoption. I'll gladly explain to my colleagues, Mr. President. What you should have on your desk is a copy of the Senate substitute. Basically, what this contains is everything in the Senate committee substitute, and I added in the amendment that was adopted yesterday that dealt with the removal of the commission to set the rate, and it also kept the ability to settle cases above $60,000 as we adopted that amendment. I tried to clean up the confusion on on where the rate can go. So to make it easier for people to understand and make it cleaner, in this Senate substitute, the director of the department has the ability to go up additional 3%. So starting January of 13, we won't have the 1.5 plus the 1.5. If they think they need the additional revenue to pay off this tail, which they do, they can just immediately just take us right up to 6 if they deem that, so it cleans it up. So January of 14, we're up at 6 from 3, and that is from 2014 till 2020 to take care of that. So that would get us to 6. By doing it that way, it should accelerate the payments on the getting rid of this backlog of cases, because we'd be doing it a full year ahead of time, and I think that speeds up the process. And then it also has one other change, which is just clarifying. It just says that any claims filed after the effective date of this bill, whenever that date is, that anything that's compensable under occupational disease would be under this new bill after the effective date, and anything that was filed before that would be on the previous language that was in the law. It just kind of clarifies, as that's the language in the law that they should follow. So that's what it does. I will gladly answer any questions, but I believe this helps take the comments we heard yesterday on the rate, cleaning it up, getting it to where we need to be as quick as possible, so we can get that done. And it just takes in the other amendment that we adopted so we can continue to have this conversation.
The senator from the second has moved for the adoption of the Senate substitute for Senate Bill 1. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? The senator from the first, for what reason do you rise?
Mr. President, to inquire of the senator from the second.
Senator from the second, do you yield to the senator from the first?
I do.
Proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President. I appreciate the floor substitute. I think it gets at some of the issues I think I may have been inquiring of you on at the time that the bill was laid over last night. That said, I have had the thing in my hand for 5 minutes or less at this point, so I am still looking through it. So just to be clear, in the original committee substitute, page 20, line 20 and 21, we had been debating an amendment to take that from 3 to 4.5%, and I'm looking in the floor sub to see where that is addressed. And I'm seeing on page 31, line 28, that reference remains 3%, but maybe that's not the right reference. Can you show me, can you just direct my attention? No, I think that is the right reference. So the amendment we were debating last night, we were striking 3 and inserting 4.5. I look at the floor substitute and it still says 3. That's page 31, line 28. Am I looking in the right place or am I not?
All right, you're on. What page are you on?
Of the floor substitute, page 31, line 28.
31, line 28.
Correct.
Okay, with the calendar year beginning January 6, shall be set and calculated against the percentage not to exceed 3%. That is correct. We're at 3%, and then what this Senate substitute does is it allows the director to go above an additional 3% to pay off, you know, the backlog of cases. So we're at 3. The director can take us to 6.
I appreciate that, and this is what I refer to in the practice as an exercise in human redlining here, looking at two documents side by side that are similar yet different. So could you please, forgive me, I've made it through much of the substitute but not all of it yet, and I haven't gotten to the part where makes the change on the percentages. Could you, I think I'm looking at it now, is that page 34, line 10?
Yeah, it's page 34.
All right. And I just want to take a look at that section. That's an amendment to sub 6 of 287.715. Are there any other differences in the language in the new sub 6 on the floor substitute as compared to the committee substitute that you're aware of?
No, the only changes, you know, is this piece right here where it just is taking us from 3 and the director has the ability to go to 6. And then the only other changes are the adoption of the amendment that we passed yesterday, and then the clarification if you have a claim after the effective date, you know, assuming this were to pass, then it would fall under this new law language, and anything before that would be the previous law of the state.
Okay, so sub 6, that's the only change to sub 6. So under the new subsection 6, you've got your base 3%, and then you can add an additional 3% through the administrative process. We don't have a second injury fund commission making that decision. Do I understand it correctly?
That is correct.
Okay, and then I'm looking at sub 7, and in the force substitute, it looks a whole lot shorter than it did in the original committee substitute. Could you explain those changes to me?
On subsection on page 34?
Yeah, exactly. Lines 17 through 21 as compared to 22, lines 83 through 99.
It just allows that once we have the backlog of cases that has been worked through and they start getting smaller and smaller and smaller, it just allows the Attorney General's office, they can reduce the number of attorneys. It's reducing its staff in proportion with the number of pending cases which remain. So if we need to go and hire additional attorneys to work through these 30,000 cases, and then we have 500 cases left, we shouldn't have the same number of attorneys that have been hired to work through this backlog.
I understand the concept. And the way it's worded in the floor substitute, it says the Attorney General shall begin reducing such staff. So is it your intention to make that mandatory rather than discretionary on the part of the Attorney General?
Because this funding is for a limited period of time through 2020, December 31st, 2020. So since the funding is limited, we want the expense to be limited. Now, granted, he can always come back to the Appropriations Committee and ask for additional revenue, for his office to move forward. But this would bring us back to where he doesn't need it for this reason, and then he has to make the case for additional revenue if he needs it for some other point, like any other agency.
Very good. And I will share with you a kernel of Missouri case law that I learned about the hard way in litigation, actually involving a securities broker dealer in our state a number of years ago. And that was, the word shall certainly implies that a duty is mandatory rather than discretionary. However, under a reasonably well-established line of Missouri cases, shall does not mean shall. It is not mandatory unless the statute imposes some kind of consequence for the failure to perform the duty. So I don't say that. I say that only to be helpful, not in the interest of suggesting that that's a reason to oppose the adoption of the floor substitute, but just to raise the issue for any who might be concerned about whether the Attorney General would actually be legally forced to begin reducing staff when the caseload drops. Yeah. I think we've
had conversations with the Attorney General, and he's fine with this provision.
Very good. Well, and I appreciate your having done that. So I just want to take a moment to make sure I understand the change that we're making relative to the original committee substitute. This sub 7, which we've just talked about on the floor substitute, was quite a bit longer in the original committee substitute, and it looked like it ensconced that additional 1.5% provision that is now in sub 6. Is there anything else that we're losing in this bill, in this floor substitute from the original committee substitute?
No.
Subsection 7?
No, it's just shorter, I think, because it's cleaner, and it's easier just to say rather than having to do the 1.5, and then we had all the stuff in the commission. So that's why it's a little bit more smaller and streamlined and easier to understand. But there's nothing else, that's been taken out or different.
I appreciate that. With respect to, and we've talked about sub 6, we've talked about sub 7, 8 and 9 are different in the floor sub as compared to the committee sub. It looks like what was subsection 9 in the committee substitute is now subsection 8 in the floor substitute, and you have deleted from the floor substitute what was subsection 8 in the committee substitute, and that's the language that we were just talking about in 7,
that,
it looks
like. That's correct.
Got it. Okay, I apologize. It's taken me a moment or two to figure that out.
Senator,
I see what you're doing here.
Senator, I do want to point out that this bill is really heavy lifting. I mean, it almost weighs like a ton just to deal with this. and it is the second injury fund, so you actually could call this a SIFTON.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. As we work through the process, well, I appreciate the floor substitute. I will say, last night we were talking about 7%, which is what the state auditor had suggested. This allows for up to 6. I don't know that the floor substitute will satisfy all, but I certainly think that it advances. Right. The ball vis-a-vis where we were when we left off last night.
It gets us going quicker. And even the auditor's report, he had his going from 7 and then dropping it back to 5, if you look at his report. So this is just, we're going to 6 quicker and we're staying longer. So I think it actually solves the problem a little bit better than going to 7 and dropping back to 5 like the auditor had suggested.
Well, and I appreciate that. And going to the point, the other difference, and I assume when the state auditor said 7%, he was assuming that the scope of claims to be covered by the second injury fund would remain as it is under current law. Is that correct?
Yeah, he would have to make the assumptions based off of what is current law rather than trying to assume what might pass. So I would think that that's how he approached it, and that was the correct way.
And needless to say, the bill, both the floor substitute and the committee substitute, the bill in its current form, of course, changes the scope of injuries which may be compensable under the second injury fund. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. So moving forward, there would be less liability to the fund and expenses moving forward, yes.
And obviously, we're beginning the process of perfection, and I anticipate there may be some additional debate on the scope of injuries to be included in the fund. So we'll sort of see where the bill ultimately lands on that. But regardless, the auditor made an assumption of 7% based on current law. The floor substitute provides up to 6% based on the possibility that the law may change in terms of what claims can and cannot be compensated under the second injury fund, or at least the scope to which they can be compensated. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's correct, but also remember that the increased surcharge is to fix the backlog of cases, and that expires on December 31st of 2020, and then it resorts back to the 3. And with the scope of limited liability to the fund after 2020, then that's the reason why that it stops.
Well, that is that's helpful. I'm glad you mentioned it. So, in other words, on the floor substitute, we have up to 6% until 2020, and then we're back down to 3.
That is correct. After 2020, or if there's an actuarial study that says we don't need it, sooner than that, then it can resort back to 3.
Now, we were just talking about the concept that under the floor substitute, there are fewer injuries that are compensable under the second injury fund than under current law. Remains to be seen whether that will, in fact, be what the bill looks like at the end of the day. But do you have any concern that by reverting back to 3% in 2020, we may recreate precisely the set of circumstances that has led us to this debate in the first place?
No, because I believe that the second injury fund that we have as it currently exists is basically one of the largest in the country, and all the different things that have been expanded over the last 60 years has made it hard to fund that liability. Whereas when we make the reforms in Senate Bill 1 and move forward, you won't have as much liability to the fund, so that the 3% should be more than adequate moving forward. And looking back in history, it was always between 2.5 and 4, and that was kind of where the surcharge always was, and it solved the problem until the economy hit everything in 2005 and capping it at 3%. So with the less liability to the fund, the 3% should be more than adequate.
Well, I appreciate your sentiment on that. I suspect there may be additional debate on that point, but it's very helpful that you've articulated your view of it, and I appreciate that. Mr. President, may I inquire of the senator from the 10th?
Senator from the 10th, the senator from Troy, the senator from the 1st is seeking inquiry of you. Do you yield to the new senator from the 1st?
Do.
Proceed, Senator.
Thank you. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
I am in my, I guess, still technically within 30 days of having been sworn in. I'm in my first month on the job, although it's a new month. But I'm new here, and you've been around a
while. By the
way,
I used that excuse for like 4 years, so.
Well, I appreciate that. So I figured that gives me another 47 months to go. So I'm new here, and we have a motion to adopt a floor substitute, and I have inquired of the senator from the second, and he has been kind enough to answer all my questions, and I think I understand what he's trying to do here. But I want to make sure I understand the implications of where we go next procedurally, to the extent I have a seat and we take up presumably a vote on whether to adopt the substitute. Are we then back to the main motion of advancing the bill, or is the adoption of the substitute going to seal the deal? In other words, to the extent I have other amendments and concerns with Senate Bill 1, do I need to raise them before we vote on the floor substitute, or is that a separate vote from perfection on the bill itself? I want to make sure I understand that before I have a seat.
That's a good question, and I am looking. We need to go ahead and do our amendments now before we adopt the floor substitute, and then that will, of course, close amendments once we adopt the floor substitute, and then we'll go to the perfection.
Very good. Very good. That's helpful. Mr. President, may I inquire of the senator from the 13th?
Senator from the 13th? Is not on the floor. If the Sergeant of Arms would please summons the Senator from the 13th and bring her to the chamber. Senator from the 13th, the Senator from the 1st would like to inquire of you. Do you yield to his inquiry? Proceed, Senator.
Senator, let me begin by apologizing for pulling you onto the floor.
Asking me to come to work?
I'm sure you were working hard in the side gallery, probably on this very issue. As I'm sure you're aware, we have a floor substitute that has been offered, and we're on a motion for its adoption for Senate Bill 1. I think you may have been in the chamber when that development unfolded. Did you see that?
I do. I have it right here.
Very good. Well, I took a few minutes to inquire of the senator from the second to make sure that I understood the changes in the floor substitute, and we had that conversation, and it is my understanding upon inquiry of our caucus leader, the senator from the 10th, that the adoption of the substitute is the question before the body, and that any amendments that we're going to need to make to this bill are going to need to be made while we're on the question of substitution as opposed to perfection. So I just wanted to make sure that members of our caucus are aware that to the extent we have additional concerns, we've got the floor substitute, and if we think that's fine and ready to be perfected and then third read, we can certainly do that. But to the extent there is more to be said about it, that now is the time. And I think
what in my absence, and since I'm new, bring me up to speed if I have anything to offer. Or we're going to perfect this right now is basically what you're telling me.
That's my understanding from our caucus leader, and I just wanted to be sure you're aware of that. I know that you and I have discussed this legislation both inside and outside this chamber.
One of my biggest concerns was occupational diseases. Can you tell me how they're being handled in this substitute as opposed to the committee substitute?
Well,
do you know what those changes are?
Well, the floor substitute is identical to the committee substitute with respect to occupational disease. But what's different, and it's important, is the pagination and line numbers have all changed. So when we bring amendments on, for example, the occupational disease portion of the bill, we would need to be referencing the page and line numbers in the floor substitute, as opposed to the committee substitute, and I don't know whether folks have had an adequate opportunity to do that. I will tell you, I myself had an amendment or two here, and I have already had a chance to do that. It's my understanding you had some amendments prepared for this bill. Is that right?
I did.
And have you had a chance to look to, at the floor substitute and attempt to determine whether the page and line numbers
changed? I have changed some of my amendments, but not all of them. So I'm partially prepared.
Understood. Well, I can relate to that. And I would say the same myself. I've managed to clean up one amendment, but not another. Have you had an opportunity to address the references, the pagination in your occupational disease amendments?
I have. You know, when we spoke yesterday, my main concern was occupational diseases. I often mesothelioma, benzene exposure, all those things are important to me, and all those things are things that can only happen to you in the workplace. And a lot of times when you are exposed to those things, especially the chemicals, those are a death kill. That's it. So, and my question would be, if we put this back in work comp, what is the benefit or what is the surviving benefit for somebody who, I don't know if that's your line of work, as an attorney, but if you were killed on the job due to a chemical leak in a plant, what is your benefit with workman's comp?
Well,
and
I
know with other parts, like I was hurt about 12 years ago and broke both my legs, and I got like 7%. So I stayed home and laid on my back for 15 weeks. And so I don't know what happens if someone dies. How did their family go on?
I'll confess this, and I'll admit this to you. I'm actually kind of a squeamish guy, and I when I entered the practice of law, I came to the epiphany that, you know, if I was the kid in the class in seventh grade who really couldn't bring himself to dissect an earthworm, that I probably wasn't going to be doing injury law.
Are you telling me I'm dealing with the numbers guys? The room's full of numbers guys.
The way I explain my law practice to people is that I don't cross-examine doctors. I do cross-examine accountants. So, yes, I would much rather be looking at a spreadsheet than a medical chart personally. Everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses, but life science is maybe not my favorite subject matter. That said, with respect to occupational disease going into workers' comp, what I can say with a reasonable degree of certainty is whatever the death benefit would be under the workers' compensation system, I imagine it would pale in comparison to the remedies potentially available in the civil court system. So you've expressed some concern about whether moving occupational disease into the workers' compensation system is good for workers, and I really share your concern, and I think there's a lot of discussion to be had on that question, and so I just wanted to inquire to make sure that we're ready now that we have a floor substitute to take up those issues.
Yeah, I'm prepared to work on those issues, Senator. The Second Injury Fund is a very difficult subject, and oftentimes it's left to attorneys in our caucus, and I appreciate that because I don't claim to be an attorney. But I will tell you the one thing that I do know. I do know that there's a young man, Michael Hartback, that I went to high school and grade school with in North St. Louis County. Michael took 1 year off to remove shingles to pay for his college education. Michael was dead by the time he was 46 years old. He left a wife and two children. And the reason he was dead is because that summer he was exposed to asbestos and he contracted mesothelioma. 46 years old. He was a very young man. The only place he could have gotten that was removing those house shingles off those houses that they were renovating. You know, there, I could go on and on like that. The fellas I work with, I retired October 31st of last year from my regular job. And the reason our retirement age is as young as it is in my trade is because a lot of folks in my trade don't live to enjoy the benefits of their retirement because most of them started work when we used asbestos for everything. It was a miracle mineral. I mean, we put it in our brakes. We put it in our house. We used it in insulation in our homes. We used it in insulation in smokestacks and plants. We used it everywhere. And it was a good product at the time, but then we found out it wasn't so good for us or the environment. So who's going to be responsible for that? I've watched young men and their wives. We have had people's wives die that I know from washing their clothes, from doing their laundry that they brought home from work. It's a disease. Mesothelioma is a disease that might take 30 years to come to light. You could have lung scarring and it may never develop, but you could have lung scarring that develops into full-blown mesothelioma, and it's very different than any other cancer, and it's a horrible, horrible death. It attacks the linings of your lungs and hardens them until you cannot breathe anymore. It's horrible for the person experiencing it, and it's horrible to watch. Every one of my partners that I started out with as an apprentice has succumbed to this disease. Every one of them. And I'm a relative, well, I like to think I'm relatively young. And they were relatively young, too, when they left this world. It was sad. And it was all due to being exposed to asbestos in the years that they worked in our plants, building our, even our grocery stores years ago. Every place, our homes, our older homes.
Well, I appreciate you sharing all of that. And that's something that I know in your line of work that you've faced and have to deal with and have seen others deal with. And I think it goes to some of the concerns that I have with how this bill addresses occupational disease. And with that, I think it's probably best that we get on to taking up some of these amendments. I know that in addition to you and I, there are some other members of the body, frankly, on both sides of the aisle, possibly even the bill sponsor still himself, who may have some additional amendments to take up. So with that, I'm going to finish this inquiry, and let's get to the business of trying to get the floor substitute into a position where we're ready to vote on it.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Senator from the 7th, for what reason do you rise?
Mr. President, I have an amendment to the floor sub.
Please send your amendment forward. Please read the amendment.
Senate Amendment Number 1, offered by Senator Holzman, amend Senate Substitute, Senate Committee Substitute, Senate Bill Number 1, page 31, section 287.715, line 28. By striking 3 and inserting in lieu thereof, quote, 7, unquote.
Senator from the 7th.
I move for the adoption of the amendment.
Senator from the 7th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment 1 to the Senate Substitute for Senate Bill 1. Would you like to explain your amendment?
Yes, Mr. President. Mr. President, this is where we left off yesterday evening. We did not hear the determination of this body on whether they wanted to follow the auditor's fiscally responsible recommendation that we solve the problem of the second injury fund. I can appreciate the senator from the 2nd's desire to take it to 6% because I do think that is a better circumstance than what we currently have. But why stop just short of a solution? And I think that the body deserves the opportunity to vote on the solution. And so I bring this amendment back before the Senate.
The senator from the 7th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment 1. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? The senator from St. Charles is on his feet. Senator, for what reason do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. Speak on the amendment.
Proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm going to speak against the amendment and urge my colleagues to not adopt this amendment. What the senator from the 7th, I think I'm right, 7th? All right. Senator from the 7th is doing is he's taking and putting a cap of 7% on the whole entire fund. With the reforms that we are making in Senate Bill 1, there will not be any need to have a 7% surcharge on workers' compensation rates to fund the second injury fund at that high of a level. So It is something that is even beyond what we need, not just talking about trying to get past the 30,000 backlog of cases, but continuing on once those are paid off. That's over 100% increase, and with the decreased liability of the fund, that is a pretty hefty increase that is really not mathematically needed once we get the backlog of these cases, which would put a hardship on businesses that are trying to expand and hire employees and already handle an up to 100% increase of what they're probably going to be realizing under the existing Senate substitute. So for those reasons, I would encourage the body to defeat this amendment so that we can continue moving forward and try to solve the problem that is good for workers, good for business, good for employers, and good for the state. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 11th, for what reason do you rise? Senator from the 2nd, you yield to the senator from the 11th. Proceed, Senator.
Senator, I'm trying to follow. We were talking about the senator from the 7th amendment last night. But in the substitute that you're working on now, you've increased it to 6%.
The director has the ability to go right from 3 to 6.
Okay. Senator from the 6 wants to increase that to 7. That's correct. And then you mentioned that there were other reforms that would make that amount not needed. So I'm wondering. Sure. In the Senate substitute, what are the other reforms that would make that amount not needed?
The additional surcharge that the director has authorized is to help get rid of the backlog of the 30,000 cases. What the senator from the 7th is doing is he is then, and that additional surcharge goes away in 2020. What the senator from the 7th is doing is maintaining that ability, in perpetuity for the fund at 7%, which they're. We've never had a surcharge that high, handle the operation and the just daily things of the fund, regardless if we have a backlog of cases.
And that may be the problem, right, Senator? I mean, the problem may be that there hasn't been the flexibility to go that high to solve the problem.
Well, even when we had flexibility, and the rate fluctuated with the economy, it was always between 2.5% and 4%. So that was operating the fund fine. We never saw one ever have to go up that high as 7. And the only reason we're going to 6, if the director deems that, is to fix this backlog of cases because the perfect storm with the economy, our lower workers' comp rates, all of it happened at once, and with the 3%. So that's why I was speaking in opposition moving forward.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 11th.
To acquire the senator from the 7th.
Senator from the 7th, do you yield to the senator from the 11th?
I do.
Proceed, senators.
I think the senator from the 1st talked about being new here. That's me, so I'm asking a lot of questions to try to follow this topic. So your amendment increases it to 7 for the surcharge, 7%.
Correct. Following the auditor's recommendation of getting rid of the tail. And then I have a hard time believing that if it reverts back to 3%, even with the reduced liabilities, that we're not going to find ourselves in the same boat 8 years from now and have to deal with some insolvency. I mean, if we have a second injury fund that's solvent or we don't. And if we're not going to, then let's just get rid of the fund.
And I think that just as I'm listening to this, the senator from the 2nd is trying to be as responsible and not taxing, as it were, some of the folks that are involved with this. But your point, with your amendment, you increase the number, but you also get rid of that time period?
We just went into the floor sub and changed the 3% to 7% to make it simple, not having to deal with, because I heard the comments of it will go to 7 and then drop back down to 5 and then ultimately drop back down to 3. Our feeling is that it can go to 7, it will pay off the tail, it will make the fund solvent. This is a recommendation from the auditor. If we want to sunset the 7 to get back to a number that's reasonable, then I'm open to that. But my feeling is that we're paying this interest on this fund. We're not paying out anything right now because the 3% that they decided in 2005 clearly wasn't enough. Regardless of the economy tanking, it's still, I mean, we've arrived at this place in time because of the decisions that were made then. So what I'm doing is trying to keep us from arriving at a place in the future where we're going to be faced with some of the same similar circumstances, because when we had the chance to discuss this and fix the problem, we came just short of doing it. Let's follow through, get rid of the tail, make the fund solvent. If it turns out that in 2020 we are flush with cash on the second injury fund and there's a change that needs to be made, I would rather change down and have the room to have this fund work. Otherwise, again, if someone wants to present a bill that eliminates the fund, then that's fine. But I think it's irresponsible for the state to authorize a fund like this to put the liability on business to say, well, it's not our problem, it's business's problem, but then not authorize the businesses to produce enough revenue to make the fund work.
Now, your amendment doesn't make it automatically go to 7.
No, it's a ceiling. It can't be higher than 7. Mm-hmm. So if the director decides that they want to do any amount in between over the 3 to get us to 7, that's fine. But this is the ceiling. So I'm just saying we can go up to this if we want to fix the problem.
I think your amendment, from my limited understanding here, really doesn't change too much what the senator from 2nd is trying to accomplish to have some balance, but it gives the director a little more flexibility and follows specifically what the auditor has recommended. And you mentioned that when you introduced your amendment.
Yeah, we very rarely...
Tell me a little more about what the auditor... Because the auditor audits things based on, you know, what's good for
numerical
the state.
Numerical facts.
Really, right. And,
data.
And although it's a partisan position, this isn't a partisan finding.
Well, that's what I've enjoyed about being in this body versus being in the House, is partisanship isn't the prevailing factor in why decisions are made in this chamber. And if the auditor is suggesting that this is what's required to fix the problem, regardless of what political party he's in, I think that we should respect his role in that capacity and follow through on his recommendation when it comes to this issue.
And again, your amendment that has, it's up to 7%, so the director would have some flexibility there anyway. Not to exceed.
So it doesn't mean that in 2020 it's going to be at 7%. It means that for now, if the director says, let's pay our debts, let's go ahead and end this cycle, it builds the flexibility in to do that. Again, it's a ceiling, not to exceed 7%. Doesn't mean that you have to. It's not a floor.
Well, I think your amendment makes sense. And I think if we don't do this amendment and add that flexibility, we're going to be back doing the same thing in the future. Now, I know it's only a little bit of an increase, but it is, your amendment is based on some real numbers and some real facts, and we should, swallow the pill, as it were, right now and go up to 7% and fix the problem.
Well, again, I appreciate the senator from the second's leadership on trying to tackle this problem. And if ultimately the body decides that 6% is the only appetite we have, then, you know,
right.
I think that that's going to be a better
position
than we have
from,
today.
What was it last night, 4.5 to 6 now?
So we've moved it.
Made some progress, more flexibility. You're just going off the number that the auditor...
Correct. I am, for lack of a better term, carrying the auditor's water on trying to solve this problem.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr.
President.
Senator the 14th.
Yes, Mr. President, I'd like to inquire of the senator from the 7th.
Senator from 7th, do you yield? She said 7. Proceed.
Senator, you know your number?
Well, I didn't hear you clearly, ma'am.
All right. Senator, took a lot to get here. So, Senator, I have been in and out of the chamber, and I was looking for your amendment. I don't see it.
I believe it was distributed.
It was not distributed?
Read, but not distributed. We can have it distributed if you'd like.
Okay, then can you, it should be distributed, number one, but can you tell me what your amendment does?
My amendment simply goes into the substitute, and it changes the ceiling from 3 to 7, which is not to exceed.
Okay, so let's go, can you tell me the page, first of all, that I'm going to?
31.
Page 31.
One in the sub.
Okay.
Line 28.
Okay, at the very end.
Okay, where it says not to exceed 3, we changed the 3 to a 7. So it's 7%.
Okay, now you said the auditor, I was just listening to the conversation you had with the senator from
Auditor Schweik has suggested that in order to make funds solvent and release the backload or solve the backload, 7% increase is going to be required in order ahead of what we are currently paying interest payments on.
And that's just to catch up?
That's to catch up. And again, this is a ceiling, not a floor. So if they use 7% for a time period at which they can move the 30,000 cases through, there's nothing that suggests by this amendment that they have to stay there. They are free to go back down. It's just this allows them, it gives them the flexibility to solve the problem.
Okay. Now, and that is with the auditor agreeing to the stipulation that people who have pre-existing conditions, some of them would not qualify under this bill?
My amendment does not address the reduced liability whatsoever. I think that your concern there is very warranted in the overall scope of the bill of what we're trying to accomplish, but in terms of solving those who have already gone through the process to get their judgment, this 7% cap or the ceiling will allow all of those judgments to be in a more timely manner addressed.
Okay, well, I have a copy now of your amendment. I appreciate your amendment, Senator. Can you tell me how many people in your district are currently waiting?
I saw that number. It wasn't very high. I was surprised that my number wasn't very high. I think it was somewhere around 14. I mean, it wasn't. There were a lot of other senators in this body that have.
And yours was low at 4. I'm looking at the sheet right now, and it looks like one of the higher numbers comes from the 17th senatorial district. A higher number comes from the 27th district, senatorial district. And then, let's see, the 3rd senatorial district, they have a very high number as well of people who are waiting. And then the senator from Troy, her district has 40 people who are waiting. In my district, I have 13.
Senator, if you were one of those disabled citizens and the state of Missouri and the court system had said you are well within your right to receive benefit from the second injury fund and no action has been taken, you can imagine the sense of urgency that you might feel and how you would want your senator to represent you in this body to help fix that problem. And I think the 6% falls just short of allowing us to fix the problem in a timely fashion.
I'm looking at this list right now. And, you know, I don't know the geography of from where each senator is from necessarily, but the senator from the 25th, he has 25 people who are still waiting. In fact, I would venture to say that the majority, the highest number comes from people who are in outstate Missouri who are waiting on the list.
Well,
from
Senator,
outstate, not from the urban core where you and I are from. But the highest numbers of people who are currently waiting come from outstate Missouri.
Well, Senator, here's what I'd understand. If you're just looking at sheer logic and you say, we have a problem, I have X amount of number of constituents who are being denied their award for their injury, I have the ability today to help solve this problem in a more expedient, a quicker fashion. Then why, if I'm willing to go up to 6% and I have the political will to say that, and a Republican auditor says we need to go to 7, and I have before me the decision that would solve the problem for those in my district that desperately need the help, I would be pressed to have another senator with those numbers stand up and say why that's not a good idea to get to the solution.
Well, I'd like to hear from those senators why we need to move forward eliminating those people who have pre-existing conditions. I mean, you know, it'd be easy because, you know, in outstate, I used to work for the former lieutenant governor, and we used to do all the letters to the editor in the rural papers. They always picked those up real quickly. But I'd be interested in noting and knowing whether or not, you know, in those areas, do those people who are waiting, you know, would they mind an editorial to be written to say those who have pre-existing conditions won't be counted in the second injury fund moving forward?
Well, we just had a national debate about pre-existing conditions, and that tended to be the one thing that everybody agreed on that was good in the Affordable Health Care Act was getting rid of the discrimination against pre-existing conditions. And if you ask or you poll virtually any citizen who's had any knowledge of this issue, they would say not having insurance companies discriminate on pre-existing conditions was the thing that they would retain no matter what political persuasion they were in. So I don't know why we are now introducing that into this fund. But again, I think that's a discussion for the larger scope of this legislation, not necessarily for this amendment that we're on.
Well,
right
I just, you know, if I'm going to have to start supporting those people out in the rural areas, then so be it. You know, I come from the urban core, but if necessary, I stand for those people in the rural areas, too. I think that they should be covered. And if myself and the senator from Troy are the only ones standing up for people in rural Missouri when it comes to the second injury fund, so be it. I'm a Missourian first.
Well, I'm glad you pointed out that my senatorial district, which is, you know, an urban district as well, only has four constituents who have outstanding awards, and here I am supporting the political will to go to 7% to help solve the cases around the entire state. So I would just ask the other senators to take a look at the number that they have in their district and ask themselves if they were one of those individuals and they got a chance, just a one-minute conversation with their senator to say, will you help me solve this problem in a faster way, what would your answer be? And that I would hope that would be reflected in the vote here today on this amendment.
You know, I have a number of constituents who own family farms or just have farms in the rural part of the state. It's really interesting. I never thought that liberals would have farms, but they do. In fact, in my district alone, I have about four farms. And, you know, it's just kind of interesting. My good friend JoJo, he was he has a family farm, and he and his cousins went out hunting. They I shot a deer in the last couple of weeks, and we ate some deer meat this past weekend. I was really excited about that, but he ended up choosing to take part of that because he was laid off from his job. Luckily, he doesn't have any injuries, but you know, I'm kind of thinking about his family members who live on that family farm, and you know, just God forbid something happened to them when they were going to work. You know, what would happen to them? But again, if I'm here to represent rural Missouri too, so be it. I would love to be an advocate for rural Missouri. Thank you so much, Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator from the 1st, what reason do you rise?
To inquire of the Senator from the 7th.
Senator from the 7th, do you yield? Proceed.
Dovetailing from where that inquiry ended, do you have the sheet with our numbers on it? I have not seen that sheet.
I believe the senator from the 14th has that.
Got it. Well, I will go after that off channel. All right. So our goal here is to do what the auditor has suggested needs to be done, right?
No, our goal here is to solve the problem. The auditor has made a suggestion on how to do that.
I agree, and your the intent of your amendment is to effectuate the auditor's solution of the problem, which is to go to 7%.
The intent of the amendment is to provide the room in the resources to fix the tail, to get caught up, and then to have the flexibility to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Okay, and I want to make sure that we're on the same page in how this plays out in the bill. Because I have some concern that what we actually do by your amendment is go to 10% rather than to 7%.
Well, I think, and that was something that we have discussed after we drafted the amendment to the sub, because essentially, first off, I don't believe that my amendment requires any action. What my amendment does is provide the maximum amount that can be built into the determination. Now, if it's saying it can go up to 7 and then the rest of the bill allows for the director to go an additional percentage above that, then yes, that could be a problem. And I'd be happy to take an amendment to the amendment to make sure that 7 in actual, the real terms, that it doesn't exceed that. Because that's the intent of this here, is to give them the flexibility to go to 7.
And I think that's your intent, too, and you've actually presaged exactly where I'm going on this. What your amendment does on the floor substitute is go page 31, line 28, strike 3, and insert 7.
Right.
But in sub 6, a couple pages later, we've got an additional up to 3%. So what I think, in order to get to 7%, I think what we actually want is statutory references to 4 and 3 or 3 and 4 or however you want to divide it, as opposed to 7 and 3.
And yesterday, when we were drafting this up, we had taken that into consideration, and I believe that we had determined that it would actually allow it to go to 8.5%, which again was, I mean, we're looking for a 7% cap. So I'd be happy to ask the body to stand at ease if you wanted to, unless you've already got it ready.
I thanks to our crack staff, I believe I do. So if you don't mind, I'm gonna offer that amendment to the
please,
amendment
please
right
please
now.
Please do.
Mr. President, I have an amendment to the amendment, and I...
Senator, send your amendment to the amendment forward. Madam Secretary, please read the amendment when it arrives.
Senate Amendment 1 to Senate Amendment Number 1, offered by Senator Sifton, to amend Senate Amendment 1, Senate Substitute, Senate Committee Substitute, Senate Bill Number 1, Page 1, Section 278.715, Line 2, striking, quote, 7, quote, end quote, and inserting in lieu thereof, quote, 4, end quote.
Senator, would you like to explain your amendment?
Yes, Mr. President, thank you. My amendment to the amendment, I think, is intended to effectuate what I believe the amendment offers intent is, and that is to provide in statute a means to effectuate the solution that the auditor believes is appropriate, which is to say allows us to get to 7%. I know that these rates are a sensitive subject. I know that the business community is very concerned about the amount of the surcharge because, of course, it's literally money out of their pockets to pay to cover this. And as long as we can get to where we need to get to have a solvent fund, we need to do what we need to do. But the business community understandably wants to make sure that these rates are that which is necessary and nothing more. And in that regard... I believe the amendment to the amendment offers the solution to the problem that I believe the amendment offer intended. So, with that, I'd ask that my amendment to the amendment be adopted and yield any questions.
Senator, do you wish that amendment to the amendment to be distributed?
Please.
Please distribute the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment to the amendment? Senator from the 14th, what reason to your eyes?
Yes, I'd like to inquire of the senator from the first.
Senator First, do you yield?
I do.
Proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. This is just a procedural thing. I know that we've ordered a copy, but now we're in the second degree. And I'm really nervous when there is an amendment to a substitute that has not been distributed, and then there is an amendment to that amendment that was not requested to be distributed. And we just really, even though this is simple, I hope that we do not move forward going to the second or tertiary degree without having that amendment, because this is a very serious issue, which I think you agree to.
Absolutely.
And I just don't want us to mess up. So just for clarification in the future, whenever we're going to the second degree or third degree, please have your amendment distributed so we know what we're considering before us.
Certainly, and I had requested that the amendment to the amendment be distributed, courtesy of the President, and I will say I'm not sure that the underlying amendment itself has been distributed, and that may be appropriate to do as well. Incidentally, while I have you, what's the number in my district? Do you have that sheet handy?
I know that you were looking for it. And I could go through them all because we have plenty of time the next couple of days. Let's see. You have 18. And actually, the senator from the second has 18 as well. Senator from the third, as I mentioned, has 39. The senator from the fourth has 10. The senator from the fifth has 14. The senator from the sixth has 15. The senator from the seventh has 4. The senator from the eighth has 19. The senator from the ninth has 9. The senator from the 10th has 40. The senator from the 11th has 8. The senator from the 12th has 17. The senator from the 13th has 21. My district has 13. The senator from the 15th has 9. The senator from the 16th has 16. The senator from the 7th has 27. The senator from the 18th has 15. The senator from the 19th has 10. The senator from the 20th has 14. The senator from the 21st has 28. The senator from the 22nd has 21. The senator from the 23rd has 21. The senator from the 24th has 16. The senator from the 25th, as mentioned prior, has 25. The senator from the 26th has 22. The senator from the 27th has 33. The senator from the 28th has 21. The senator from the 29th has 12. The senator from the 30th has 15. The senator from the 31st has 15. The senator from the 32nd has 7. The senator from the 33rd has 13. And the senator from Buchanan has 12. Does that answer your question?
It more than answers my question, and obviously all these people are waiting for compensation that it has already been adjudicated that they're entitled to, and so we need to try to solve this problem. And I will say, the list you just read off, I think, underscores the importance of us actually getting the job done on this bill and arriving at something that can be signed into law to take care of the people you just referenced.
Well, I did all that because I wanted to receive your amendment. I'm grateful for that. But here's the deal. The question that I have in the list of people that I just mentioned, how many of them have pre-existing conditions? I'm a stickler for this. How many of them have pre-existing conditions that are not defined by this legislation?
Right. No, I agree. In fact, I think I myself have an amendment that's intended to address that very concern. Because you're talking about people that already have been adjudicated to be entitled to a recovery, and how many of the, 27,000 odd who are waiting for their day in court, so to speak, on this question have injuries that might not be compensable now? I think they may have a due process interest in the current state of the law, but going forward in time, there are going to be any number of people whose rights will be substantially curtailed by this bill in its current form, and that's why it's important for us to address those questions in the hours and days ahead.
Well, thank you for your clarification. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from Boone, what reason do you rise?
Senator, are we on an amendment, the underlying amendment of which has not been distributed?
That is correct.
I would ask that the amendment be distributed.
The amendment will be distributed.
Also, Mr. President, I do notice that an amendment has been distributed. It ends in O2F.
Is that the correct amendment?
Is that the current amendment that we are on?
That is the current amendment we are on.
Mr. President, I notice it does not have the name of a senator or the identification of a senator on it.
It was offered by the senator from the 7th.
Mr. President, don't we have a rule that when you distribute on the floor, you do have to have an identification of the senator who has it distributed?
We're talking the amendment to the amendment, Senator?
This is the amendment to the amendment.
That is correct. It's duly noted, Senator. We will correct the error. Would you like it redistributed with a name on it, Senator?
Is it going to be? Because if not, I would ask that it be.
Yes, it will be.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President.
The amendment to the amendment will be redistributed with the senator that offered its name on it.
Mr. President.
Senator from the 7th, what reason do you rise?
To inquire the senator from the 1st.
Senator from the 1st, do you yield to inquiry?
As I
proceed.
Write my name on my amendment to the amendment, and I greatly appreciate the senator from Boone's concern and gentle admonition to a new member of the body. Thank you.
Well, Senator, we knew we were going to have a few of these before it was before the first month was over. I want to draw attention, as I was looking through here, something that the senator from the second had brought up. When this fund fluctuated based on need, it went from 2 to 4%. And what I'm seeing here is essentially what your amendment to the amendment does is sets that cap at 4% in all circumstances, with the exception of when we go to subsection 6, which then authorizes an additional amount up to what would be 7% to fix the current backload of problems. But it also may be available there in the event that the fund starts to have problems that got us to this point. But what really happens is that, let's say that we fix the problem, we get rid of the tail, the director of the workman's comp says, okay, you know, we're gonna go back to 4%, as your amendment would state. Now, that 4% being an increase to the 3%, in my estimation, is where the fund needs to live if it's not going to get us back in this position a few years from now.
It certainly guarantees, at a minimum, an increase to the current cap. And I think under any set of circumstances, given the backlog of claims, the interest charges we're accruing, some adjustment to the cap immediately is appropriate. That's what your amendment does. That's what my amendment to your amendment does. That's the intent of what you and I are both trying to do here.
So I think we're actually having two good government decisions here. The first we're doing is increasing that 3% cap under normal circumstances to a historically accurate place where, when it was fluctuating on need, it did go to 4. So once again, this is a place of fiscal responsibility, even for the liability on businesses. And if the business community says we want to have the second injury fund exist and we think it has benefit to our overall bottom line, then we need to build in the necessary responsibility to the program, which will allow them, especially based on historic precedent of it having reached 4%, this would give that flexibility. And then the subsection 6 says, well, let's give additional flexibility to go up to the 7% in the event that it's required.
Right. And I'll say, too, another reason that I think it may be a good idea for us to put 4% as what I would refer to as the base cap. And we are a bicameral legislature. The matter of rates is one of considerable sensitivity, understandably so, to the business community. And one never knows what might happen on the other side of the building. You could see any different number of permutations of what we're talking about here in this body. But if you told me that, you know, it's possible that if we were to go 4 and 3 and have it sent back to us with just the 4, but with more claims that would remain compensable, which in some ways would be the worst of both worlds. You would have greater recourse to workers, which is important. On the other hand, you might have limited your means to pay. But we just don't know what the House is going to send back, and this at least allows us one change that might help to address the problem in case there's nothing else that winds up getting done.
No, I agree. And you and I, having served in the House and getting adjusted to this new role, the old saying that the House makes the news and the Senate makes the laws, what we're doing here today is making a sound, good government, fiscally responsible policy change that will enable this. Have you heard from the business community in your district that they want the second injury fund to remain, that they would like to see it be a fund that's available to the citizens of Missouri?
Well, I
a fundamental question that really needs to be answered.
I don't want to generalize here, and I probably have already been guilty of that, insofar as no one group is monolithic. I mean, what I would tell you is that different businesses, small and large, are differently situated relative to both second injury fund and occupational disease. There are some companies that for whom occupational disease is a much greater concern than second injury fund liability. On the other hand, there are many businesses for whom it's just the opposite. So, what I would say is the idea and intent behind the second injury fund is to allow workers who have a pre-existing condition to recover from the synergistic effect of a second injury that occurs in their current employment, and that inures to the benefit of the employers who are paying a premium surcharge as opposed to
free market insurance rates, which are generally higher. So
sure.
If we can get this right, it works well for everybody.
So we're socializing the risk, essentially, and allowing those who are disabled to have a remedy that is actually more cost-effective for businesses to have to deal with the fact that, and that'll get us into the mesothelioma debate when we talk about what costs are associated with which ailments and why they shouldn't be treated the same. Now, you and I'd like to revisit that discussion when we get to a point in this legislative process. Right now, I want to stay focused on this amendment, but I think that they're connected.
As a supporter of free markets, I might prefer the term externalizes to the term socializes, but I think we both understand the concept.
Right. You know, you say potato, I say potato. Well, Senator, I think that your amendment to my amendment is a good one. I think it's good for the overall legislation. I would hope that the body would hear the numbers from their district and understand that there are real people who are waiting. They've gotten a promissory note from the state saying that you are entitled to this. We have not had the will to deliver on that, and I think that we do our citizens a great injustice by not following through with a solution that will actually work.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the second, what reason do you rise?
May I inquire the senator from the first?
Senator from the first, do you yield the senator from the second?
I do.
Proceed.
So, Senator, you have the amendment to the senator from the seventh amendment, correct?
I do.
Okay. And the senator from the seventh amendment is taking our surcharge to 10%, and you're bringing it down to 7% with your amendment.
I'm concerned that the effect of the amendment as originally offered could be to authorize a cap as high as 10%, and I don't think that was the intent. I think that was the unintended.
That's great.
Potential.
I'm happy you're coming our way.
I appreciate that.
I really look forward to continue to work with you this session as you continue to come our way. So I'm going to vote against the amendment simply because it makes it even easier to defeat the underlying amendment. But I am glad that you are coming our way on reducing that surcharge. So thank you, Mr. President.
Any further discussion on the amendment to the amendment? Senator from the first, you're recognized to close on the amendment to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. President. I close.
Senator first renews his motion to adopt amendment to the amendment number one, to Senate amendment number one, to Senate substitute number one, to Senate bill one. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
The noes appear to have it. The noes do have it. The amendment to the amendment fails. Any further discussion on the substitute amendment? Or Senate amendment, correction, Senate amendment. Senator from the second, what reason do you rise?
So just to clarify, Mr. President, to speak on the amendment, Mr. President, just to clarify, we are back on the underlying amendment from the senator from the 7th that would raise the surcharge to 10%, which I think is probably way too high than what we need. And I myself am going to be voting in opposition to this amendment. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 7th.
I withdraw the amendment.
Senator from the 7th withdraws Senate Amendment number 1. We're back on Senate Substitute number 1. Further discussions? Senator from 13th, what reason do you rise?
Mr. President, I have an amendment.
Send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
No, it hasn't. I ask that it be read.
It will be read. Madam Secretary, please read the amendment.
Senate Amendment number 2, offered by Senator Walsh. Amend Senate Substitute, Senate Committee Substitute, Senate Bill number 1, pages 1 through 3, section 287.067, by striking all of said section from the bill, and further amend said bill, pages 3 through 7, section 287.120, by striking all of said section from the bill, and further amend the title of enacting clause accordingly.
Senator from 13th, would you like to explain your amendment?
Yes, Mr. President.
Under current law, workers suffering from work-related occupational diseases may seek relief by bringing a civil action against their employer. This includes workers who suffer from serious and deadly work-related occupational diseases, such as mesothelioma and cardiopulmonary disease, that involve long-term workplace exposure to toxic substances. That would change the bill. We're taking occupational diseases out and leaving the law as it currently is.
Senator from 13th, you move for the adoption of Senate Amendment number 2?
I do.
Senator from 13th moves for adoption of Senate Amendment number 2. Any further discussion on...
President.
Senator from the 14th, what reason do you rise?
I'd like to inquire of the Senator from the 13th.
Senator from the 13th, do you yield?
I do.
Proceed.
Senator, how are you doing this morning?
I'm good, Senator. How are you?
I am delightful. That's a term I picked up from a new friend from South Carolina. Apparently in the South you say delightful, and it has several different meanings. It has very positive meanings, and it has other meanings. But I am delightful in the true meaning. So I know this is a huge issue for you, Senator. I haven't had an overwhelming group of people who've come to my office to talk about occupational diseases. But because I know it's important to you and people who you represent, I wanted to hear a little bit more about it. I have not been educated on this. I'll just be frank about it. Again, I like when people come to my office or get me at home and have a meeting, sit down with me, to tell me the scope of what is important to them, either for or against it. Since that has not occurred at this point, I would love to get an education from you at this point. I know that you were talking about it earlier. Again, I've been in and out. I have a group of librarians who are coming to my office today. I love librarians, so I'm having hosting an event for them right outside my office today. So can you tell me, give me a brief education on occupational diseases and why you are trying to take this language out of the substitute that is before us today?
Well, I don't think that occupational diseases should be camp arena. I think it should be left where it is, and for the simple reason.
Which is in workman's, so it is in workman's comp?
No.
It's not.
We took that out, and I don't remember when we did that, but it hasn't been out very long.
Okay.
Right now, they can bring a civil action against their employer. They can go to court, and they can receive damages. They would be limited. I don't know what the limits are in work comp, but it would have to be. It wouldn't be enough to compensate somebody that might contract this disease at 35 years old, that has 4 kids in grade school, and their wife is left to carry on to raise those kids, educate those children, feed them, and clothe them for the next 20 years to get them to adulthood.
Okay, so...
I've watched lots of guys. My line of work, we all had nicknames. And there was Lefty. I worked with Lefty for 25 years most of the time. And Lefty always referred to me as a dumb old girl in a lovingly way. And that's how they talked out there on the construction site, Senator. It was not an insult. It was an endearment with him. But I watched Lefty, the last 5 years when I went into the house, when you were and I were serving together, I was working with him. And when I left the job we were on, he retired shortly after I left, and he walked kind of like this. And it was lack of circulation. He'd been diagnosed with mesothelioma. But the catcher was, he was walking like this, like a 100-year-old guy. Lefty was somewhere in his late 50s. Before Lefty was 60, he had died from mesothelioma. He had retired at 55. About a year and a half, he received his benefits from his pension that he had put into for since he started when he was 16 years old. So that's a long time, almost 40 years.
Did he have children,
years.
A wife?
Yeah, he did have children. He was not married. He had 2 children, and he had some beautiful grandchildren. His grandchildren, I see pictures of them all the time on Facebook. And he was very proud of them, because I've watched these guys You know, you become a family. We've always talked about the Senate being a family. These guys are our family. When you work, a lot of times you spend more time, especially when you labor for a living, you spend more time with your coworkers than you do with your family because you need to compensate your set wage. So you want to work some overtime, you're with these guys all the time, and you watch it evolve. You watch happy times, bad times. You watch them go through marriage. You watch them go through divorce. The best part, and I've told you, and I think I've told the senator from Kansas City, best part of your life is when you become a grandparent. A lot of these guys don't get to do that. I experienced that 2 years ago, and she's a spoiled brat, but I did it all. And that's, you know, I watched Lefty get when his grandkids were born. Two of them were in Texas. I think there's four down there now. I think one is in Springfield. One or two. She's about 13, beautiful little girl. But he doesn't get to see all this stuff anymore. But there's thousands of lefties out there. He's had two brothers die from the same disease.
This weekend, I was studying the second injury.
You know, I was very impressed with your educational process because you sure learned a lot Saturday.
Well, that's what my intention was. You know, we have a lot of advocates and opponents on certain issues, and what I have a true disdain for is when there are advocates or opponents to an issue and they come to our office and they ask us to support or work against something and they didn't take the due diligence to educate us on the issue. You know, there are certain issues that I really care about. There are a handful of them that, you know, I know them in and out. But for those issues where it's my secondary or tertiary interest to get involved with, I have a high expectation for those advocates or opponents to do that due diligence and help educate me on that. So I was able to do that this weekend. And the only reflection that I have on what may perhaps touch your issue on occupational disease is going back to the industrial age. And you know, when we were in our country's history, when we were developing as a country and we were putting people into jobs, you know, we were creating widgets and gadgets, and then we discovered that we could transport those widgets and gadgets by train. Well, in order to operate a train, you needed coal, which means there was a whole other industry of people who had to dig for coal. But what I learned and what I know is in that industry, there are a lot of things that develop health-wise. And the only thing I could relate to that is South American history, because I know, you know, a lot about, you know, those who were digging mines for silver or coca plants, and they're trying to make Coca-Cola or whatever they were doing. But there are hazards involved in those industries throughout time. And so I could say, okay, I understand some of the mining issues in South America, and this is closely related to, you know, people who are digging in the coal mines. From that standpoint, I can understand how people who are working in certain industries have risks, because they are trying to make America great by their work that they produce.
Well, Senator, you know, the problem with some of these risks, you could say, well, you knew the risk going in. With occupational diseases, we didn't know the risk going in. And then when we discovered the risk, not all employers were very good about taking care of the risk. Now, I have watched safety evolve over the last 35 years of my career. I can tell you that I've worked at powerhouses where, you know those coal trains you're talking about? Do you know how the coal gets from plant to plant? Comes in on a rail, and the rail goes over like a pit. And they open up the bottom of the train, and the coal drops out. And in my job, I insulated pipes. So in some of these pits, along the edge of these pits, there's these pipes. And they need to be insulated, and they need to, what goes through there is water to keep the pit cool. Well, I was there on a job, and this has been probably 20 years ago. I was by myself. It's a coal burning plant. and I'm in this pit. I'm insulating these lines, and all of I'm on a, which this is what I was on. I was on a piece of plywood on a 6-foot ladder, standing on top of coal that's in a pit that's shaped like this, like a V. So what do you think's happening? No, this, and me with the coal.
Okay.
You know, it's just kind of sliding down.
But isn't there dust
okay,
that...
That would never happen today. That would never happen today. We've learned better processes. Because I actually called the contractor. I said, this is not a one-guy job. I need some help here. You don't get help. Put another slab of plywood on top of it. You'll be just fine. Well, I can tell you what I did that day, Senator. I put a bucket of tools in the back of my car, got in my car and left and called the union hall and said, you know, get some other fool to work for that guy because I'm out of here. But you don't always have that benefit. Things aren't good right now, and a lot of guys sometimes will take shortcuts to keep their jobs, and that's not good either.
That's not good for our infrastructure.
That's
when people
not
take
good.
Shortcuts, period.
Well, I'm not saying they take shortcuts as far as our infrastructure. They take shortcuts in trying to get the job done as far as, you know, I can't get this grinder in here, so I'll take the guard off of it. And what that does, you're going to grind down what you're working on, but you're also putting your fingers at risk. You're putting your eyes at risk. You're putting your whole, you're not going to, the chances are you won't go home that night the same way you walked onto the job that day. And that's what every good employer wants, and that's what every good employee should want, is to go home just like they came to work that day. But if you leave occupational diseases in this, it's not fair because people, companies willingly knew the hazards and nobody did anything about it for a long time. Now, do accidents happen? Absolutely, accidents happen. But if an accident happens, there's such an inquiry anymore that you really go out of your way to make sure you're not going to be, you know, that you're not going to throw a 6-foot ladder up and you're going to hit a valve or something in a plant and release something into the air that could be toxic or could kill you.
There's this, your predecessor used to cite movies all the time, and there's this one movie.
Is that what he did all those years up here?
All those years that I served with him in here, there's just a couple, but he used to cite movies, and there's one with John Travolta, and it's one of the movies that I saw when I was a pre-law student, undergrad, and in this movie, there's this company that was putting a chemical into water, and the water ended up getting into the local stream. That same stream, you know, was the source of water for the people who lived in that community. And they ended up getting cancer and all these other diseases. And so John Travolta, you know, whatever his character was, you know, he ultimately ended up going to the EPA and saying what this company did was wrong. Then they got into the minutia of who the subsidiaries were of this national company or this global company. And then years later, even though he lost in what he was trying to do, years later the EPA decided, hey, you know, this corporation did know that they were putting not only their employees, but the people who lived in that environment at risk, and they shall be responsible. Is that something close to what you're talking about? Like when a business entity knows
sure.
that they're putting their, you know, their employees and or the community at risk, and they go on and continuously do the process or do whatever their business is, putting people at risk, and then move on as business would have it. But there are people who are dying of cancer and other things.
Absolutely, and I can't. Okay. You know, I've known. You know, we just had an example about a year and a half ago. A plant I was working at. It was a plant employee actually, and I always work for a contractor in these plants. But he was exposed to benzene, and he actually survived. But he's in a nursing home now. And he'll never come back to work again. I can speak to mesothelioma because I'm familiar with it. But that's not the only industrial disease out there. That is not the only killer out there. And that's why I don't think it's fair to leave this in the bill and put occupational diseases into the workman comp arena.
So do you think it was a genuine move to put this in the substitute? Or?
You know, we throw that word around here, genuine. We just toss it around. I will tell you, Senator, that I have one core belief in this building, and that belief is that every person in this room, all 33 of my co-senators, they are genuine in what they do. I do not think, even though I might disagree with them and I may not like what they're doing with the bill, I really believe that they philosophically are doing that. They're doing that for philosophical reasons, not for personal gain. I think they really want to make this place a better place to live and this state a better place to do business. But by removing occupational diseases, the only one it hurts is the working guy.
And I think it's going to be really easy for us, or easier for us as a body, to move forward adopting your amendment. And I think it's the right way to go. We obviously must deal with this issue that is so near and dear to your heart. Again, as I stated earlier, I do not have an overwhelming group of people who are talking to me about occupational therapy. I am not blaming them, but I know that you are the north, your district is to the north of mine. I'm sure and I know that we have overlap in a lot of areas and a somewhat similar constituency. We both have the same amount of poverty in our district. Which is what my mantra is going to be about this year, is to talk about poverty in the state of Missouri. And whether or not it's in your district or mine, or if it's in rural Missouri, I'm going to address poverty in every single bill that we attack this year. And so for those who do live in my district who have dealt with occupational disease, I want to be able to say that I have stood for them, that I stand for them, and that I will continue to. And I think that by having this language in the bill, we're not fully accomplishing what the senator from the second is wanting to do, which is to deal with the second injury fund. And as I stated yesterday, by going forward, increasing the cap, that's the right direction to go. But I am a stickler, as I mentioned before, for addressing those people who have pre-existing conditions. We've not even gotten to that conversation yet. Not yet. But I know that there is a whole plan of what we're going to discuss on the floor when it comes to this bill. But when we get, ultimately, to the section that deals with pre-existing conditions, I'm going to have a lot to say. We're going to have a lot to say.
And well, Senator, I'm looking forward to that, and I'm hoping you can educate me, because if you, I spoke the other day with the senator from the first. And he asked me how I felt about parts of this bill, and I told him my concern was really the occupational diseases, because I will be the first to admit when I don't fully understand something. And anybody that says that they picked up this bill and had never heard of the Second Injury Fund before or knew a little bit about it, read the bill and said, I know what this bill does, well, then they're the smartest person I've ever met, because I've been dealing with this since I came into the House. So we're talking 12 years, and it's a very complicated issue.
It's very complicated, and I tell you, the hours that I spent this weekend does no justice to the time it takes to fully comprehend all of this. And, frankly, as long as we're on this, I'm going to continue my education on the Second Injury Fund. And even though I don't have people knocking on my door to talk about occupational disease, I'm going to find out more about it and have my own understanding, even if no one comes to my office or knocks at my door at home about this issue. So I understand where you are coming from. I think that you are approaching this in good faith, And I do think that your amendment should be adopted because this issue alone belongs in a different place. It does not belong in this bill. It should be in a different place. And if we're going to move forward on the second injury fund, if we are going to try to address the chokehold that was established in 2005, we're going to have to be earnest about it. And that's what I think your amendment does. So thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion. Further discussion. Senator from Green, for what purpose do you rise?
Mr. President, I seek unanimous consent to introduce some very special guests to the body.
Seeing no objection, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. Behind me in the upper gallery, we have some students today who are with the Community Learning Center, the Division of Youth Services, and they're here with their teacher, Andy Pruitt, and their group leader, Jason Dunn, and their youth specialist, John Howerton, who also happens to be the son of our Senate administrator. And I would ask that the members of the Senate make them feel welcome and ask them to stand and be recognized. Thank you, Mr. President.
Would the guests from the Senator from Green please stand and be recognized? Thanks for coming, guys. Thanks for coming to Jefferson City and the Capitol. Have a great day. Further discussion. Senator from the First, for what purpose do you rise?
To inquire of the Senator from the Second, please.
Senator from the Second, do you yield?
Yes, Mr. President.
He does. Proceed.
All right. So we are now on to occupational disease by virtue of the amendment from the Senator from the 13th. I want to go back. I want to start by going back to the year 2005. We had a change in the law on occupational disease that year. And it's my understanding you were in the building at that time. Is that right?
I was in the other chamber.
And now, did you term out of the House or?
No, I came in a special. My senator resigned, and I came in a special into the Senate in April of 06.
I see. And how long had you served in the House by that point?
I was in my second term, so 4 years.
Very good. Very good. Well, 2005 presented a different environment in this building than we had seen in almost 50 years up until that point.
Correct.
You had a new governor that year who was a member of the same party as the majority in both the House and Senate, and I believe that was the first time since the Eisenhower administration, I could stand corrected, but that you had had governor, House, and Senate all in the control of that particular party. Am I right about that?
I remember it was somewhere around 50 years, so that probably put us back somewhere close to Eisenhower.
So 2005 represented really, in some ways, the first best opportunity for an overhaul of workers' compensation law and occupational disease law from the point of view of the party that is now in the majority of both chambers. Really the first time in a long, long time. And so that was an issue that was very much on the table in the 93rd General Assembly. And, in fact, there was a very substantial piece of legislation that passed pertaining to occupational disease that year. Was there not?
Well, I don't think the legislation was pertaining to occupational disease. I think the workers' compensation statutes went from a liberal viewpoint of how it was construed to a strict, and the words occupational disease were left out because since you have a strict interpretation, if the words aren't there, then it won't be construed. So I just believe it was an oversight that those words were not put in there, but when you changed it to a strict and they weren't in there, that's why since 05 the courts have ruled the way they have been ruling. But
well,
the case law, I mean, but for 50, 60 years before that, occupational disease was in the purview of workers' comp until 2005 due to that oversight.
And that's helpful. And you went to the point I was going to next draw out, which was that for a long time prior to 05,
occupational disease was in workers' compensation, but the effect of the legislation in 2005 was to take it out. And was that...
The effect wasn't to take it out. The effect was it was a misseen byproduct of that legislation that accidentally took it out. But the intent of the legislation in 05 was not to take it out of workers' comp. It was to keep it in, but it was to more strictly interpret the workers' compensation laws rather than liberally on how they had been viewed for the last several decades.
But in fact, courts subsequently interpreted the 2005 changes to have the effect of taking occupational disease out of the workers' compensation system.
Correct.
Is that right?
That is correct. Because since we went to the strict construction viewpoint and it wasn't specifically outlined as being covered, they viewed it then that it was outside.
So is it your view that as a matter of both public policy and legislative intent that all along occupational disease has been and or should have been and or was intended to have been within the workers' compensation system?
That is my position, yes.
And why do you believe that it's appropriate for, frankly, dreadful occupational diseases that are frequently fatal to be covered by workers' compensation rather than left to remedy in civil court?
Well, I mean, first off, that was the precedent for 50, 60 years, and that's how it was always handled. And so when you look at this as a workplace, injury, that's what should be falling under workers' compensation. So I know we can have the argument, especially when you hear some of the cases and the heartstrings of how people have to tragically deal with their last few years on this planet in this life. But when you kind of look at it from a different perspective, of there's more people killed in car accidents in workers that are on the job than anything else. But we always treat that as the same, and it's a workplace injury. And so I understand that some of the things you talk about, especially with mesothelioma, that can be very gruesome and bad, but that's the way it had always been handled. And the far vast majority of workers' compensation things that end in death are still handled under workers' comp. And we wouldn't be having this conversation if it wasn't for the oversight back in 2005. And I didn't see a whole lot of people bringing this issue up previous to 2005 on why are these cases treated in work comp and not in the civil court specifically.
Well, and let's talk about workers' compensation versus civil court. I mean, there are some important differences in terms of how it can play out in legal proceedings. I mean, first, would you agree with me? The remedies are quite a bit different in the workers' compensation system versus what you might be able to obtain in front of a civil jury.
I'm not an attorney. I've never had a work comp case or a civil case. I do not know what the award parameters are on a civil case versus what you could achieve versus workers' comp. I do believe the workers' comp is an agreement, with the employer and the employee that there is a specific remedy so that they can, have access to, a compensation or funds or what have you in a workplace injury so that they don't have to go and do the big expense in proving everything in a civil court. So I think there's a benefit, and I'm sure there's, depending on how you look at it, there might be a increased award in a civil court, but it might be more expensive to get there because you have a different causation that you have to prove. But you're an attorney, you can speak to that.
Well, I can. That said, it's not my area of practice, but you presage my next question, which is you have a difference in remedies, but you also have a difference in standard of proof, right? I mean, you have to demonstrate causation in a court of law, whereas in workers' compensation, the standard of proof is much lower. Is that right?
I believe there is, and don't quote me on what that standard is, but I do believe there is a different standard. You're correct.
So it's in workers' compensation, it's easier to prove your case, but your remedies are limited. In civil court, you've got a bit more work to do to establish liability, but you might be able to get a wider array of remedies. And I think we can all agree that in different cases, different injuries might play out differently in terms of whether a worker is best advantaged going through the workers' compensation system as opposed to in civil court. However, in the case of many occupational diseases, going to the remark of the senator from the 13th, one of the first things she said is, you know, these are things that you get one way and only one way, and that's on the job. I mean, you don't get, you don't contract mesothelioma by not being around asbestos, do you?
I believe that is directly deal something with asbestos is for that specific type of cancer.
Right. I mean, there's one cause and only one cause of mesothelioma. You have to be exposed to asbestos to get it. And while you have some folks who live in the vicinity of some of these plants that have had exposure as well, most of the people are, like the senator from the 13th, most of the victims are asbestos workers who, earn a living around the stuff, and we hope that they are able to do so safely. But obviously, we wouldn't all be standing here today if that wasn't always what happened. I'm struck by your suggestion that the legislature made a mistake in 2005. I mean, it was the first opportunity in a half century to change the law on this subject matter. And I have to think that an awful lot of thought and work and effort went into it. And I just have a very hard time imagining how that could have happened, given what was at stake, given the uniqueness of the opportunity, how long it had been in the waiting. But I take you at your word that, in your view, it was an unintended consequence of the language that was chosen. But I would like to inquire of some other members of the Senate who, I believe, voted on that legislation when it was pending in the House. Mr. President, if I could inquire of the senator from the 8th.
Senator from the 8th, it doesn't appear that the senator from the 8th is here.
You know, and I can say there were, well, let's see if we can get him first.
Sergeant of Arms, please summons the senator from the 8th. Senator from the 8th, the senator from the 1st would like an inquiry. Would you yield?
Yes.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator, and I let me begin by apologizing if I interrupted you from other business.
I appreciate the apology. I will tell you I've got a group in my office from my district, so I heavens. Appreciate the apology.
Well, I really feel very badly about interrupting that. If they are still in your office, there are a couple of other folks that were all in the body or were at least in the House, if not the Senate, at the time we last made a substantive change in occupational disease. If you've got a group in your office, I am more than happy to inquire of one of the others.
I would appreciate that. I'd like to give my constituents the priority that they need, but I'm always willing to yield to an inquiry.
I appreciate that. I will let you get back to your constituents. I am terribly sorry. I will inquire of one of the others who voted on this in the House. That said, I may want to take up my inquiry with you later, but let me let you get back to your constituents. I'm terribly sorry.
All right. No, thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President. May I inquire of the senator from the 12th, or from Nottoway?
Senator from Atchison, I don't believe he is here. Sergeant of Arms, please summons the senator from the 12th. Senator from Worth, the senator from First has asked for an inquiry. Do you yield?
I do.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator, and I apologize. We are. I'm trying to talk to folks who were at least in the building, if not in this chamber, when we last voted to change substantially our occupational disease law in our state. And I was previously inquiring of the senator from the 8th, and it turned out that I had summoned him from his office when he had a group of constituents from his district visiting with him, and so I cut him loose right away. I did not mean to interrupt him. So the first question I want to ask you is, have I interrupted you in the midst of important business?
Well, you have, but being the gracious member that I am, I'm willing to go ahead and have dialogue with you.
Well, I greatly appreciate that, and I really do mean it. I don't mean to be getting in the way of what people are doing with their days. That said, we had a very important change in the law in 2005 pertaining to workers' compensation. Do you remember the legislation to which I'm referring?
I do.
And you remember the House at that time?
I was.
And if memory serves, I think you voted in favor of changing our workers' compensation law at that time.
I did.
And subsequently, prior to that point, occupational disease had always been in the workers' compensation system in Missouri, and since that time, it hasn't been. And of course, now we have
through
the floor
a judicial.
I'm sorry.
Fairness, right? That it came out through a judicial ruling, not through a changing of the statute.
Well, and how did that transpire? I mean, but there was a statutory change in 05, and there was a subsequent court ruling determining that the change in the law had, in fact, removed occupational disease from the workers' compensation system. I mean, that's what happened, right?
There was reform in 2005. There was a court case that said that, although I would argue whether or not that was actually ever the intent. I do not believe that was intent. I would tell you that from my recollection, we never had that any of those discussions. But with that said, we are where we are now.
Sure. Well, and I appreciate that. As a matter of public policy, do you believe that occupational disease is appropriately something that is confined to the workers' compensation system?
I do actually believe that. I actually believe where the senator from the second is trying, how the senator from the second is trying to fix occupational disease, I agree with. I disagree with the way he's trying to fix the second injury fund, but right now those two have been thrown together here, so we're having to deal with them tandem.
Well, let me ask you about occupational disease first. Why do you believe, I mean, what, in your view, why is it good policy for occupational disease to be confined to the workers' compensation system?
Well, my understanding, Senator, is that we are the only state in the nation where it's currently outside of workers' comp. It is also my belief and my understanding from my time here that that was not act, and that is not because of an act of this legislature. That is because of an act of a court. And I believe that is the responsibility of the legislature, not an overactive judiciary, to make those decisions, which is exactly the process we're going through right now. So for me, you know, unfortunately, these things are never easy. It's never black or white. But the reality is the world that we live in today is a competitive environment. Every other state in the nation deals with it through workers' comp. Unless someone can convince me otherwise that there's a better way to do it, which to date they have not been able to do, I believe that Missouri should follow the same path as the other 49 states who already deal with this within their workers' comp system.
Well, I appreciate that. And while we're talking, you had mentioned that you disagreed with the second injury fund fix that Senate Bill 1 ensconces. Could you please explain to me what your disagreement is with the senator from the second?
If it was up to me, we would eliminate it. I believe the second injury fund has come and gone. I believe it's time to eliminate the fund, which essentially means that risk, for lack of a better term, would be shifted into the policies, the insurance policies that are purchased. But candidly, I believe that the private sector insurance industry will do a better job of defending off trial lawyers than an attorney general who gets contributions from them. Candidly, just with all due respect to everyone who is in office today, who've been in office, who may hold office in the future, it's not person specific, it is process for me.
And I appreciate that. And in fact, our current attorney general has called for the fund to be closed, has he not?
You're absolutely right, Senator.
And is it fair to say that some of his concerns might be some of the ones you just expressed?
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I've actually been through, on the second injury fund part, there was actually an interim group where we looked at it a few years ago. And I say a few years ago, it's probably 3 or 4 years ago now, Senator. And what I remember in that, there was a time period there where there were changes made, where we increased the lump sum settlements from $40,000 to $60,000. Once that happened, there was an expediting of everyone, or not everyone, the greater majority of people to use the lump sum. And for the longest time, we couldn't understand why they moved the lump sum off of the payment, off of the guaranteed payments. And my understanding, and boy, like I said, it's been several years ago, so I would need to get refreshed on this, Senator. But if I remember right, if you're receiving a government payment today, whether it's disability, Social Security, whatever it may be, a settlement, a monthly settlement payment out of second injury fund actually impacts that. So it's actually reduced because of the money coming from second injury. A lump sum payment out of second injury doesn't impact any of your other governmental income streams. So right, wrong, and different, I don't think it was ever designed to be a loophole. The reality is if someone takes a lump sum payment out of second injury, it doesn't impact if they're on disability or anything else, or Social Security. If they take a monthly payment out of there, then it does. And so it's almost an inverse, they are financially penalized, for lack of a better term, Senator, for taking a payout versus taking a lump sum. Therefore, there is inherently a greater incentive, for lack of a better term, to take the lump sum payout. And when it was increased from $40,000 to $60,000, that happened to be enough that would allow the trial lawyer or whatever lawyer was representing them to take a third, they took two-thirds or whatever that, however that breaks down, and everyone would move on. Now, the challenge that created is we had this mass exodus and or spending, however you want to say it, out of the fund, while the legislature in 2005 had capped the revenue going into the fund. And so it's like every other debate in government, do we have a spending problem or do we have a revenue problem? I believe we have a spending problem. And candidly, Senator, I don't believe that gets fixed as long as the fund is in place. So for me, that's why I would advocate, much like the Attorney General, close the fund, let's figure out how we're going to deal with the backlog that have already been adjudicated, with the understanding that from here forward, it's going to be the private sector through the industry sector that's going to negotiate and or settle these things from here on.
Well, that's all very helpful, and I appreciate everything you just said. I was not here in 2005, and I have had a very limited opportunity to review Senate Bill 1 and 130, which was the bill that year that led to the interpretation of the change on occupational disease. Do you recall, was that the same bill in which we capped the fund, the second injury fund as well? Was that the same piece of legislation, if you remember?
If I remember right, the workers' comp, when we did the workers' comp reform, that's where the cap on the second injury fund, I think it was all done in that same bill.
That's helpful. I wasn't here and don't recall. Well, thank you.
If
let
I
me
remember,
let you
the
get back to
it. Injury fund is a portion of what's paid on workers' comp, and therefore, when the cap was put in place, it naturally created that cap there.
Well, thank you. Let me let you get back to what you were doing. And, Mr. President, if I may inquire from another person who was in the building at the time, the senator from the 13th.
Senator from the 13th, do you yield?
I do.
She does. Proceed.
We're on your amendment here. So you were here in 2005 in the House, correct?
I was.
And do you remember Senate Bill 1 and 130 from that year?
Well, as I told the senator from the 14th, at that time I concentrated my efforts on the OD. So I do remember the bill. I do remember working to get it out of the bill.
And do you remember, I wasn't here, but I remember hearing and having been told that there were some people that were, you know, pretty explicit at the time about their interpretation of what that bill was going to do. And, you know, they have made it sound as if they were doing jumping jacks and waving the red flag and doing everything they could to make sure that the people who were pushing through that legislation were abundantly forewarned that the effect of what they were going to be doing was going to be to take occupational disease out of the workers' compensation system. Do you remember hearing anybody say anything like that at that time?
Yeah, they ended up taking it out. They thought it would be better in the courts. It was better for the folks that ended up with these diseases, and I thought it was good. A lot of folks were predicted that we would be here. Said, we're all going to be back here working on this in about 5 or 10 years because the legislation wasn't adequate enough to fill the gap. We were really kind of underfunding it then.
Well, and I know that we had, I think, this occupational disease bill both years that I was here in the House in the 96th General Assembly. And for all I know, we've taken up that language in this bill, which your amendment is removing, every year since it was passed, or at least since the court decision.
You did work on this. You worked on this after when you were in the House?
Yes, there was occupational disease legislation that was on the floor briefly.
No, I don't know, because I guess I should have as part of my training. But when I walked out that door, like many legislators 3 years ago, it was like out of sight, out of mind. It was a change getting back into the regular world. So I really didn't follow you. Every once in a while, I'd turn on the computer at night to listen when I knew you were working late. But I really didn't follow a lot of legislation in those 2 years.
Well, do you recall if there was occupational disease legislation in the 94th, 5th, and 6th General Assemblies?
I don't recall there being any standalone bills, but it was in the original bill that we worked on in 05. There was always bills there that would, what we'd always be working on, one labor issue or another, but it was different subjects and it wasn't necessarily specifically occupational diseases.
Well, let's go back to 05 and that debate. I mean, we talked a minute ago, and I don't know if you're in here when I was inquiring of the senator from the second, but, you know, for workers' compensation versus civil court, there are some differences. You have a higher standard of proof in civil court, but you also have a broader range of remedies that's available, or at least better remedies, in my view, or at least a better potential remedies, depending, not always in every case, but frequently. Generally speaking, I think that's the case. And can you understand how,
folks might, in the interests of attempting to minimize their liability, make the calculation, correctly or incorrectly, that perhaps, at least at the time, that they might have been better off putting occupational disease into the civil court system because you have to actually prove negligence occurred,
absolutely.
Whereas you don't at workers'
comp. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that a lot of folks probably thought that a lot of people didn't take time to document. I can go over 33 years and tell you where I was every day, every working day for the last 33 years. And the reason for that is so I know when I was exposed and what I was exposed to. You know, we keep talking about just my craft being, you know, exposed to this disease, but the guys that put the brakes on your car, the steam fitters and pipe fitters, the carpenters that might be building a scaffold, and happen to knock some pipes loose in a plant or knock stuff off of a plant. Anybody that was in the construction field in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s were exposed to asbestos. So it you know, it's a disease that attacks a broad range of people. And you asked earlier, Senator, how you get it. It's a fiber that's so minute that if you get some fibers in your lungs or down in your chest, you can cough and you can release that. You know, if you have heart surgery, they give you a pillow to hold and they ask you to cough because they want you to work that stuff out. But these fibers are so small that once they're in there and embedded in your lungs, which once you inhale it, you can't get them out.
No.
They're not going to come out. And that's why it's so deadly. It's just a terrible, terrible, deadly disease. And I forget who it was. I don't think it was a senator from the second, but somebody in the House always used to refer to a Dr. Seuss book. Terrible, horrible, deadly, dreadly day or something. But that's what this disease is. But it's not the only occupational disease out there, and that is why my amendment is so broad, to take the whole definition of occupational disease out of this Senate committee substitute for Senate Bill 1.
Well, we've heard briefly from one other senator who was in the body at the time, and at more length from two others, the senator from Nottoway and the senator from the second. And they both expressed the view that at the time that Senate Bill 1 and 130 was up for a vote in the House in 2005, that it was not their understanding or their intent that the effect of that legislation would be to remove occupational disease from the workers' compensation statute. Do you believe that there were people who might have actually intended that consequence ensue at the time? Who nonetheless supported that legislation?
Say it again, Senator. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Sure. We've had some people say we didn't. You know, we were all for Senate Bill 1 and 130, and we didn't
right.
mean for it to remove occupational disease. But do you believe that there were people at the time who supported that overhaul of workers' compensation who actually intended for occupational disease to be removed from workers' compensation?
Sure, Senator. I was one of them. You know, they may not. It might have been an unintended consequence.
For some.
But nonetheless, it was a consequence. And that's where we are today. And it is working for the thousands of Missouri workers as it is now. It's where it should be. So I just feel we shouldn't go backwards. Why would we want to step back? You know, whenever we change things around here, we have good intentions, but a lot of times we end up changing it on the backs of the working people, or the people that can least afford what we do. You know, and if you are somebody that was exposed to this disease, could you imagine that your only recourse is going to be workman's comp? And after everything else that's happened to you, somebody says, well, we're going to write you a check for $60,000, and that'll take care of your family after you're gone or whatever, and I don't know what amount it is. We spoke about that before. I'm not an attorney. I don't know what percentage the loss would be or how a death penalty death benefit would be calculated under workman's comp. But I can tell you it's not going to be a compensation that would be equal to what somebody could receive in our courts, which is a fair and just way to do it when we sit there and our peers decide and listen to the evidence.
Well, I'm going to let's talk for a minute about a $60,000 lump sum, and I'm going to run the risk of proving that this is not my area of practice.
But that's going back to the second injury fund for settlements, right? From when we raised it from 40 to 60.
Well, but let me ask you this right now. I mean, if a worker's second injury is an occupational disease, is there not the possibility that there could be a second injury fund payout or award entered on the basis of an occupational disease? Maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't. You're an attorney. I am not an attorney. I don't pretend to be an attorney. I've never been accused of being an attorney. But that.
Three senators standing on the floor. Senator from the second, for what purpose do you rise?
Would you please place that bill on the informal calendar?
That bill will be placed on the informal calendar with Senate Amendment Number 2 pending. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of House bills on second reading.
Seeing no objection, the calendar, House bills for second reading. The junior senator from St. Charles County. The junior senator from St. Charles County has been recognized.
Mr. President, House Committee substitute for House Bill 110.
House Committee substitute House Bill number 110. An act relating to vacancies and time limits for certain offices.
Financial governmental organizations and elections.
Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. We'll proceed to the order of business for announcements.
Announcements. Senator from Phelps.
Mr. President, your Committee on Veterans Affairs and Health will have a short executive session in Pershing Gallery immediately after recess.
Announcements. The senior senator from the second.
Your Small Business Insurance and Industry Committee will be meeting at 1 p.m. in SCR 1.
Further announcements. Further announcements. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. No further business coming for the body. I move the Senate stand in recess till 5 p.m. this day.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate will stand in recess until 5 p.m. this day.